There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
Hey, this is Tyler.
And I'm KC.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
What's going on, all my woods people? We are hanging out on the Nebraska Furniture Mart couch. It's warming up quickly here in Texas. I hear it's snowing in Montana from my friends that work for Meat Eater up there. By the way, this podcast is brought to you by First Light. Last night I was wearing some Trace pants and getting mosquito bit through them, but they are cool.
They are lightweight. Cool. That's one of the things, right? Mm-hmm. We need some permethrin. We need to buy some of that.
That keeps the mosquitoes away?
No, but it keeps the ticks off, and I'm way more worried about ticks than mosquitoes.
Dude, it's just you and Michael getting them ticks.
Listen,
like crazy,
Lyme disease is bad. I don't want that.
Yeah, I know.
For sure. Like,
that's kind of scary.
It's like a... kind of rampant these days. There's weird people getting Lyme disease. Almost like it might have been in some type of
vaccine
thing that was widely distributed.
Can I say that on this podcast? I think we're going to get one of them flags, aren't we?
For sure, dude.
Well, we're actually looking right now at some.
I have a question for the audience.
Florida stuff, Airbnbs.
Is Florida in March too hot to sleep?
Yes.
Outdoors.
Dude, where we're going, it's hot there year-round.
Yeah. But what if there's, like, what if there's good stuff there?
There is. There's lots
there's
of good
camp,
stuff.
But look, here's an indoor. Six. Oh, this
I
is
could do
one,
that.
Dude. Oh, my gosh.
Sleeps five?
Yeah.
Five beds, dude. Come on,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, a Coleman camper. If you own Coleman or any other camper company, reach out to us. We need a partnership.
That's pretty nice.
Are we sure there's five? This
says,
might be the thing.
It said okay. It. There you go.
Oh, well, they're going to be in this. There's one, two, three, and then there's going to be, you know, it's like the make-a-bed.
Oh, yeah.
Which we can do that.
Eric loves those.
Yeah.
And then the other two will have that Humpty bunk bed back there.
Yeah, they'd be like old times,
Humpty
man.
Dumpty.
Is this the one that y'all have? Is this the one that, Greg, you live in currently? Similar layout, though, huh?
Humpty Dumpty.
Dude, there ain't no way that this is long enough for a human to lay down.
Dude, I don't know. Eric sleeps in that pop-up, and it's not super – like, I can't stretch out in it for sure.
Yeah, you're long-jawn, dude.
But here's the thing. If you haven't watched that pop-up video, KC and I, and Eric actually, put a video together recently where we hunt – some public stuff in Oklahoma, and we also do like a rig rundown on our pop-up situation. If you haven't watched it, you should go to YouTube here in a little bit and check that out. It's a pretty cool little video. Eric has an encounter with a Mondo in a really cool, like, kind of discreet spot that I had decided to put a trail camera prior to that trip, and we were seeing some deer moving in daylight, and he ends up in a lockdown situation with a big old buck. Got some cool footage of it. And anyway, it's worth watching for sure. It's one of our more recent videos. Also, If you listened to the podcast last week, you know we were doing some axes hunting recently. That video is on the channel as well, one of the latest videos that we've done. And the picture is just me and another guy glassing, but there's actually some axes action, some full draw, some arrow release type stuff.
So, axes action.
Go check that out, too, if you're interested in our YouTube stuff. If you're not and you just like radio and podcasts, then sorry you had to listen to that. So right now, we're looking at some Florida Airbnbs. And, KC, you don't like how some of this stuff looks cheap and dated, right? That's
no.
A big problem for you.
Yeah, it's a big deal, man. But maybe
– is that because people have snowbirded down there for so long that they just – none of this – a lot of this stuff hasn't been updated? And also, I guess, it's like, when did people start deciding to move from New York and snowbird in Florida? When was that?
You know? When did Florida – I mean, did New York go blue? That would be –
you think?
Well,
I feel like there's a lot of people that just – like – have places in Florida for just the snowbird effect.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely true. I mean, in fact, Eric's parents have talked about moving to Florida. Mm. They're from, you know, central southeast Illinois.
South north.
Yeah, south north.
South northeast Oklahoma.
Southern northeast. So, like, it's an appeal for people. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's because the moderate weather throughout the year, right?
Yeah.
You just have like 3 days of extreme weather every year with hurricanes. So it might be why it's a snowbird thing, right? So you're away from Florida whenever it's hurricane season, but you're there during the summer.
And it looks like a hurricane might have hit some of these properties.
Maybe.
A hurricane of paint.
Hit me like a hurricane.
A hurricane of red paint and off-whites.
Yeah. It's a boomer thing, we decided. And if you're a boomer, it's okay. You can't choose when you were born, but you can choose how you act.
You can choose when you're born again, though.
Can you?
You can.
That ain't a very Calvinist statement of you over there.
Yeah.
What are you thinking about?
I'm trying to put something in our Drive, our Google Drive.
Yeah, I think the camper is going to be the way to go.
You think?
We found a camper for rent, you know, on Airbnb.
You ever heard that song? Campers for sale or rent. Rooms for just, yep. Rooms for 50 cent. Is that it?
Yeah.
That's how the new version goes.
I don't know how they even charge for that, because the whole thing is that dude's homeless, right? So I don't know how they figured it out. But Florida's an expensive place to travel to. That's what I'm figuring out on.
No way, dude. Flights are cheap.
Yeah, but if you want to stay anywhere, it's kind of like a
You say
casino.
Travel too.
Okay, well, you're right.
I mean, if
you're
it
right,
would
you're
include
right.
flights, wouldn't it?
This is a guest favorite. Let's just take a look.
Just trying to do you like you did Brian yesterday.
Hey, yeah, I know. That's right. You're right. I don't need to be hypocritical.
But we are, man.
Travel in. It's an expensive place to travel in. And Airbnb is ridiculous nowadays, too, with the cleaning fees and all the extra add-ons they put
on. Do they
there.
Have those? I thought
yeah,
one
look,
of them didn't have cleaning fees or something.
$200. No, VRBO has, like, extra money you have to pay to just, do something. It's like insurance or something that they make you get. Mm. It's like, this is cool.
There, you want me to? Never mind.
We have a good friend who plays a little baseball we're going to go see in Florida. And then we're going to do a lot of outdoor stuff in Florida. If you have some thoughts on that, let me know. Because here's the deal. There are crazy things like blue-green nematodes that you can hunt at night because they glow in the dark. And then there's like the more standard stuff that I've dreamed about my whole life.
Like largemouth bass.
Largemouth bass. Florida. I don't even know if you call them Florida strain over there. They're just largemouth bass. You
yeah.
go up in there saying, I want to catch some Florida strain largemouth. They're going to be like, well, what else do you think is here?
Talk about what you mean by Florida strain.
Well, it's an interesting thought, right? Because in this continent, we've got a lot of sunfishes. It's mm-hmm. like a thing that's on the North American continent. The largemouth bass being the largest of the sunfishes, I'm pretty sure, right?
I believe you're right.
And
except for the oceanic sunfish.
Yeah, that's not really a sunfish. Moi moi, isn't that what they're called?
Yeah, I think that's right.
But they aren't what a lot of people would call a sunfish, but they are in that family. Long story short, the Florida strain is the biggest as far as genetics go.
It'd be like the Iowa strain of whitetail.
Yeah, it's like how American Samoans or like, you know, Samoan lineage people are big, burly people, or Nordic people have that, you know, tendency to be really strong, right? Like Florida strain largemouth can, in the right circumstances, grow to be the biggest of all the species. In fact, it was in Georgia, but the current world record, well, that's actually tied with a fish in Japan. But, you know, the long-standing world record came from Georgia, but it would be of the same, like, genetic, not genetically isolated, but like the genetic area, lineage of those fish. And that picture, by the way, if you've never seen it, I know you have, is wild looking. Because they got this fish strung up on a pole, and they're carrying it out, and its eyes are all bulged out, and it just doesn't even look real. It looks like it's 22 inches long and weighs 22.1 or something
four
like that.
4 ounces.
22.4.
So, actually, the Japan fish weighs 22 pounds, 5 ounces. Uh-huh. So, it weighs an ounce more than the longstanding world record, but is technically tied because you have to beat the world record by 2 ounces to get an IGFA world record.
Which is wild. But it is the long-standing rule. It's not like they made that up whenever that happened, not to break it. Kind of like there's other world records that may or may not have had some like weird things go on in the antler department, right? With rules like that. But
I feel like that's a rule that was set into motion to make sure that like there wasn't too much water on one fish or something like that.
There's a lot of discrepancy with fish weights, right? Mm-hmm. Not weights and fish, but fish like the weight of a fish.
Weights and fish sometimes too.
Yeah, which is always so weird, right? Because a fish can weigh an ounce less at the end of the day than it does in the beginning of the day just because they sit there and burn a lot of calories and, you know, defecate and all that stuff. So
throw up.
Yeah. Belch. You know what? How weird would that be if a fish weighed more because he belched and got rid of that light gas that's inside of him?
And then ate something?
Mm-hmm.
Man.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Well, a lot of times if you put something like that in the live well and haul it around all day, it'll be a bunch of dead shad in there at the end of the day.
I'm worried we're going to be in Florida in the post-spawn time for largemouth. Uh-huh. But
who knows when we're even going to be there, you know? But, yeah. I mean, it's probably spawn right now.
I bet you it is.
I mean, it's got to be. For the southern Florida stuff, at least, I don't know.
I feel like Okeechobee is like the motherland. And I don't know if it's just because if it's that good there or if that's just where all the fishing media has taken place because it's a big body of water. It's like Okeechobee is super unique, right? Because it's like this depression where limestone kind of eroded through springs over hundreds or thousands of years, and it has left like a depression of water that water holds in, and so it's a huge lake, but its average depth is like 3 feet or something like that, right?
I'll look that up for you.
Yeah, there's probably some stats. So essentially it is just premium sunfish habitat, and I would imagine it's good bluegill fishing. In
9 feet
average, 730 square miles. It's huge, right? Like it's the Great Lake of the South. In fact, this might be the biggest natural lake in North America, excluding the Great Lakes. Well, freshwater lake, because Salt Lake's going to be bigger than this. But anyways, you know, average depth of 9 feet. So the deepest part's probably going to be 20 feet at the most, I'd imagine.
10th largest natural freshwater lake.
In the U.S., is that what it's saying?
In the United States. Contiguous 48, it's the second largest. After Lake Michigan.
Lake Michigan is completely encompassed in the U.S.?
So the other four Great Lakes are going to be in those top 10, right? Mm-hmm. So, maybe not. No, that won't work, actually.
Second largest natural. Oh, so.
Oh, because.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I don't know. That's weird, isn't it?
Those are contradictory stats. Oh, 48. I guess there's five more in Alaska.
Oh.
Is that what they're saying?
Well, so Lake Superior is number one, Huron, Michigan, Erie, Ontario, Lake of the Woods, which is part of Minnesota.
It also goes into Canada, yeah.
Iliama, Great Salt Lake, which is not a freshwater,
Oahe.
Right? Is that, I guess it's considered freshwater because it's inland?
It's not freshwater.
And then Okeechobee at number 10.
But Oahe is also not natural, right?
Dam.
Yeah, it's not a dam. Yep, so this sure. is just kind of confusing.
Yeah, I don't know.
But looking at that, it's the second.
It's still a Mondo.
Second biggest one in the U.S. That's just in U.S.
Yeah.
Okay, it makes sense. So lots of big fish in there. And we're going to try to fish it. You know, I watched Roland Martin whenever I was a kid running them canals in his bass boat before there was power poles on the back of them. And he'd pull up there, and you're thinking, oh, this dude's about to whip out that spinner bait and do all this. No, he puts him a big old golden shiner on a hook 5 foot below a cork and chunks it out there and just goes to ripping toads, dude.
That's how you do it.
I would love to do that.
That's how you do it, man.
I think we should.
Yeah, I think we should too.
Mm-hmm. Well, the bass fishing world has changed a lot. You know, I mentioned the power pole thing a while ago. Mm-hmm. Roland Martin didn't have power poles. I'm sure he had him a hummingbird or a Lowrance or something like that on his boat for depth finding. Maybe some sort of a sonar to just kind of see where fish were. But, you know, all that started out, they're called depth finders, you know. So a lot of that electronic stuff started out with that, and then they incorporated flashers to kind of see if there were suspended fish. And then finally you had like readout screens that would kind of display. I don't know what you grew up with. We had a really old hummingbird one, and it had like these pixels that were like almost looked like geometric shape blocks or whatever they call them that you do in like second grade. Mm-hmm. Where like if you saw one that was 8, it was 2x4. You were like, oh, that's a big fish down there in the water somewhere. And you didn't really have any clue about where it was.
Mm-hmm.
You probably had a little bit more updated stuff from time to time because y'all did a lot more, you know, bass fishing type stuff than what I did growing
up.
Yeah,
I don't know. It was pretty basic fish finders for us.
Did y'all ever get into side imaging and stuff when it first came out?
No, we've never had side image or anything since then. Mm-hmm. So.
If y'all didn't know, recently, what are you looking at right here? This is interesting.
I'm looking to see what the biggest bass are in Florida and where they have come from.
30-incher right there. Goodness.
This is a the state record. This is interesting, y'all, because of what we're fixing to talk about. So I won't spoil the news here. But there was a 1727 pulled out of a small, I guess, private lake, I would assume, in 1986 from Florida, and that's the state record, it looks like. So, Florida, for whatever reason, is considered one of the best bass fishing states there is. But as far as big bass, the Florida strain largemouth is considered to be a big growing bass. But in Texas, we have several fish that are bigger than the state record of Florida.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where Land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to Land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years, and not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
It is interesting. It's like the something about the conditions where we are in certain situations make for bigger fish than in their home realms. And it's kind of like the lionfish epidemic in the saltwater world of Florida, where it's not as much of a size thing, but they proliferate really, really well because they have no natural predators and their conditions are ripe on all these Florida reefs to be able to just, you know, kind of become a problem, which for us, big bass are not a problem. It's awesome that we have them, but it's kind of the same thing. We're like, in their native range, they do well, but you bring them somewhere different and they do awesome. Stripers are a lot like this, you know, like there's like Lake of the Ozarks and some other lakes where freshwater stripers, which don't actually exist natively, do really, really well and grow to really huge sizes. And you're looking at right now the top 50 largemouth bass in Texas and the top, let's see, the top, what, four are bigger than the Florida record?
Top five.
Top five.
I believe. I think we're at 727. Is that what I said earlier?
1727.
The top five, the top six were caught from Lake Fork, which is where you and I grew up.
Something about that, don't we?
And the top five of those are bigger than the state record for Texas or for Florida, I believe. So what's interesting about this, I'm trying to connect some dots here for you. In 1980, Lake Fork was impounded. In 86.
Which means it's legal to go out on the lake.
It's dammed and it's filling up, if not even sometimes full. Mm-hmm. But they allow you to go out on the lake and start doing some. So it's impounded, dammed, in 80, one of the things they did, and we're going to speak stuff that we know. Some of this is stuff is like historically maybe inaccurate to
there's
a touch.
There's
some lore involved, mm-hmm. and some stories that we have that may or may not have details. So you can fact check it, baby.
Let's
go. Fact check too. But we don't need to hear too many emails from y'all on that stuff. But if you feel like so inclined, then do so.
Some of the things we're going to speak to today are from being in the civilian population that's mm-hmm. in and around a major bass lake.
Yeah, and a major explosion of mm-hmm. bass fishing and trophy bass fishing. I said it, trophy, y'all.
Woo-hoo!
I'm just going to go ahead and make one disclaimer. This is all to my knowledge. I may mess some stuff up, so I'm sorry if I do, but this is what I know. This is how I understand it. When they begin to think about filling Lake Fork up, there's ponds all in this creek system. There's a lot of stock tanks. A lot of them are mm-hmm. stock tanks. They put fry and or fingerlings in a lot of these ponds and let them grow as the lake starts to fill up in this creek, this big creek system, and based around Lake Fork Creek. And so as the body is impounded and the water rises, at some point it overtakes and overfills these dams and these ponds, so that when we go to fishing it in the public, all of a sudden, as soon as you start fishing it, there's some decently mature bass in this that didn't cost them a whole lot to grow right? They grew them to a small size, put them in a pond. They start growing in the pond, and now there's 2, 4, 6 pounders or whatever to be fished for.
My dad said they were catching like 8 pounders in 81 on H&H spinnerbaits. Said they would
go. Good old H&H.
Huh?
A good old H&H.
They're good, man. If you don't know what H&H is, it's like a it looks like a beetle spin or something. It's a small spinner that you wouldn't throw on like a conventional bass rod. It's kind of an ultralight type thing.
But they're heavy.
They are pretty heavy. A Zipco 33 is the perfect rod and reel combo to use an HH with. It has a unique hook that you attach the hook to. It comes in like a little Ziploc baggie, and you attach the hook after you get it out of the package. And they're weedless, which doesn't mean weedless. It means they kind of stay out of the weeds a little bit.
They don't get as much weed on the
that's
hooks.
That's right. The
they
hooks,
get weeds on the spinning rod
then they
or
stop,
whatever.
They stop spinning around. The spinner. But there's different colors, but that hook is unique because you thread it through this loop on the back of the bait, and you can make it where it points down or points up, and people usually always point them up so that they are more weedless. But they're bass catching machines. And my dad said that one time, so used to, you'd go out on the lake, you know, before I was born, right, and before you were born too, and there weren't really boat rents established yet whenever it was filling up. So they would just go to where the FM roads just deaded into the lake, and that's how you access the lake. Mm-hmm. No parking lots or anything. And so they'd go down there and wade fish the banks. And he said one time they brought, like, their cousin out with him or whatever, and he was just missing fish left and right, just getting frustrated. And they got to looking, and he didn't have a hook in his H&H. He was just throwing a hookless H&H out there trying to catch fish.
Kind of hard, yeah, man.
But they were – that and silver spoons. He said they just used to catch big old fish just on spoons and H&Hs.
Mm-hmm. I remember spoons being popular early. So 6 years after impound, the state record was broken by none other than Mr. Mark Stevenson, who still guides today, I believe. In 1986, he caught a fish on an artificial that was 17 pounds, 0.67 hundredths of a pound. So
does 17, his fish 67. Have a name?
Ethel.
That's Ethel?
Ethel is Mark Stevenson's fish.
So the 18-1-8, we're probably getting to that in a second.
Yeah, so Mark catches his fish. It's a state record. It's still, I believe, the biggest fish caught on artificial. Definitely, according to this, in Texas. And it sparks this thing that is basically now all of a sudden has turned into very quickly after he catches his fish, a big bass mania among the culture, and eventually turns into basically the department decides we're going to try to make this place, you know, like Disneyland, you know, for fishermen. This is going to be where the next world record comes from, essentially. So Mark's fish, which I believe is named Ethel, starts the Sharelunker program. And so the Sharelunker program is a program that for a long time, it has changed recently, but for a long time was 13, if you caught a 13-pound fish or bigger, and it was 100% Florida strain when they tested its DNA, then you could donate this fish to the state fish hatchery. They would send a truck to Lake Fork. They did it a bunch over the years.
He don't look no different now than he did.
He's aged well. That fish looks ridiculous. But they will send a truck. You put it in the aquarium in that truck, and they take it to the state fish hatchery, and they will spawn the fish so that they can have fry from 100% Florida strain that gets Mondo. And then they give the fish back to you to do whatever you want with. So a lot of guys release it back where they caught it. Some people will take it to their lake and put it in there. And so anyway, this program starts, and I'm trying to do some research on, I forget the guy's name who headed this up. It's such an interesting story, and I wish I was a little more prepared for this. But essentially, this guy became kind of just accidentally the leader of this Sharelunker program that became so prolific and efficient at creating big bass over the years. And so essentially Lake Fork starts this big bass frenzy in Texas, and it's a race to try to make the world record happen. So let me see right here. I got too many tabs up
right now.
Where's Where's that? Here we go. Okay, so back to the records here. Just a couple of, about a year and a half later or so, Mr. Larry Barnes catches Valentine, which is a Valentine's Day 17.29, number Toad. Five. It was number two at the time.
Before we move on from Mark Stevenson, I just want to say I had a like a teddy bear version of Ethel.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I had like a little green soft plush bass that was Ethel, and it had – like old man glasses on it and stuff, like as a real old fish. You
that's
know what
funny.
I mean? Yeah, I wish I bet I still have that somewhere up in my parents' attic or something. That would be real cool to find that thing.
Yeah.
You know, like it's kind of wild that you talk about the fish crap. I mean, they were making children's toys about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it was.
Well, and Johnny Morris with Bass Pro Shops, founder, I believe Mark was, they paid him like a lot, like several thousands of dollars to keep that fish. There it is right there.
Yeah.
And that's Bass Pro Shops. I guess
that's what
where
it
you
was.
Got
they,
it.
Yeah, yeah, this ties in.
They
we got
made
it.
Money off this fish.
We
you
got
know?
It at the Missouri Bass Pro Shop when I was a little
yeah.
baby.
And
there.
That's where they took Ethel was, I believe they put Ethel in that and it like drove
yeah,
hundreds of
her.
Thousands of customers to Bass Pro at
There's
the time.
A picture of me as a child looking in that tank in Missouri, and we bought this plush toy while we were up there. You were talking about redneck vacations, dude. In 1989, you know, I was like one or a little after I turned one, my family took out in a Dodge Ram Charger to the OG Bass Pro Shops in Missouri, and that was our vacation.
Man.
We went to Bass Pro Shop in Missouri.
So cool, dude.
It's just such a different world, man. I love it.
It is, man. It
I like
is.
The simplicity there.
Yeah, for sure. And that was, you know, that was a big deal. It was like, this. Here comes see the state record fish in this lake. And so, you know, this is something I've been wanting to
– Go ahead.
Well, this, you know, I've been wanting to do a lot – more of a deep dive on this, and we'll kind of try to breeze through this a little bit. But
you're talking about Valentine.
So yeah, essentially,
is Valentine the controversial one?
No, I wouldn't say. Okay. I would say the most controversial one is the state record.
Okay.
So
I reckon why Valentine doesn't have a length on there listed.
Yeah, who knows?
These are interesting because Barry St. Clair's fish, which we'll get to in a second, is short. And then Stan Moss's fish is 28 inches long, which is a monster. Which 25 isn't short, but for the poundage, it is.
Yeah, sure. So, and I've done, man, I've looked at these records. There's records of the Sherlunker fish over, like, every year. Historically, it shows you where they all caught, how much they weighed, what the length was, what they're caught on a lot of times. It's really interesting stuff. And at one point, it was a goal of mine to catch a Sherlunker. But I'm a lot more busy now. I got kids that – you know, I got to care for and that kind of thing instead of just, you know, worrying about myself and trying to catch my biggest fish ever. So, but at this point, Lake Fork starts, it's in proximity within an hour and a half of the DFW Metroplex, which is a massive metroplex with a lot of wealthy people that can buy big bass boats and graphs and all this stuff and go and catch, you know, fish on the weekends at Lake Fork. So it starts this thing, kind of led in charge by a man named Ray Sasser, who used to write an article for the Dallas Morning News, and he would essentially put a report in there and kind of report on these big fish that were caught weekly and stuff, and a lot of people would see that and just get to itching so bad they had to go out to Lake Fork. So there's a lot of people fishing. At one point in the 90s, they were estimating 300,000 people a year fished Lake Fork, which is a 26,000-acre lake, I believe, 26-something. So not a huge lake, right? And people are catching fish. Well, in 1992, January 24th, 1992, according to this, Barry St. Clair catches a fish. And I believe this is a pretty – it's been debated, hotly debated over time, because what Barry St. Clair says is that he caught it on a minnow while crappie fishing down by the dam, which is the thing that people do on Fork in the wintertime, deep water. There would be a certain amount of population who might be just jealous individuals that would say that he hooked a crappie, and as it was coming up, that he caught the fish on a crappie. And Which would make it illegitimate, which would also be very hard to do because you still have to hook the fish more than likely, right?
Yeah, unless, on light line.
Yeah.
Yeah, with a hook that's already in another animal's mouth.
Sure. So it could be done, though. But anyway, that's one of the ones that's been hotly debated. But the fish is the only 18-pounder ever caught in Texas, and it was 1818, and it has been the state record since 1992. But there were several scares along the way here and there, and even before that, where mid and high 17-pounders. In fact, number 2, 3, and 4 are within 0.04 of a pound from each other. And so just big, big fish.
What else is crazy about this is that there's not a lot of people. No one has experience. The list of people alive today who have experience holding a fish bigger than 16 pounds is real, real small, right? So if you catch a fish that's 15 plus and you don't weigh it, you don't know how much that thing weighs. Mm-hmm. You know it's big, big. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, there's always like, oh, it might have been a new lake record caught, or not always, but like that's a thing that happens. You just look at this list, and we can see 1 through 20 right now, and there's no fish below 16 at that. Mm-hmm. If I caught a 16, I would for sure think I'd caught the biggest fish in the world.
Oh, for sure.
You know,
I say it all the time, but I caught a 10.25 one time out of Fork, and when it came up out of the water, if it would have shaken the bait or lost it somehow, it was a 12 pounder in my mind. Uh-huh. I mean, it's just the way it is. You've never seen a fish that big.
Yeah.
You don't know, you know. Oh, so that's the way it is.
We caught an 11-1, and the fish didn't measure. It was 21 inches long. It wasn't big enough to keep. And you can't process that it's that short when you first see it because it's so big. So you're thinking, I don't know how big this fish is, you know.
So that's another thing. Like Fork installed early on was a slot limit, and I believe it was 16 to 21 at first, and then it ended up being 24 and has been that way for a long time. Cannot keep a fish from 16 to 24 inches and only one over 24. So that allows you to bring in these big fish and weigh them.
They have recently – I don't know if I'm getting ahead of you here, but – in some of the tournaments, they have figured out a way to circumvent that and have officials on boats with all the guys to be able to. And I don't know, in the recent Bassmasters tournament, they might have just let them bring them in. Is that how it worked?
No, that was the same way. They've got whatever they call them, essentially like refs in the boat, you know. So long story short, Lake Fork over years and years has produced a lot of big fish. At one point, I knew I counted there was 36 in the top 50 were from Lake Fork. And one of my dad's good friends is still there tied at number 50.
There you go. He's holding in there tight.
Yeah. But there are two. There have been no 17-pounders caught since 1991 until 2022, and there has been two in the last 2 years caught at OHIV. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, guys. Most of the fish – I bet you most of the fish in this top 50, if they could trace their heritage back, it would be to a sharelunker from Lake Fork. Mm-hmm. There's a high chance. And so now what we've got is this, like, is Texas is an awesome fishery all around. We've got Falcon and OHIV, and Toledo Bend was famous a long time ago and still produces really big fish too.
Rayburn, man.
Like some of these big, big, you know, Caddo's the only natural lake in Texas. And,
It's got one on the list. It's got a 16-pounder.
A couple of 16s.
Yeah. Conroe. I forgot about that lake.
Conroe. So we've got Amistad. We've got really good lakes here in Texas, and a lot of it is owed to what Texas Parks and Wildlife started with Mark Stevenson's fish in 1986, which is the sharelunker program, the ability to spawn these big, big Florida strain fish that now grow bigger in Texas than apparently they do in Florida. And I'm sorry if I've messed that up, but the information I saw seemed that 1727 was the Florida state record. So if it's different, y'all check me on that. But this all goes to say that Fork in the 90s and late 80s was especially – it was the most special lake probably in the world at the time. Mm-hmm. And they thought for sure it was going to be broken. In fact, there is a replica of a 20-pounder that was found floating. And I don't know the full story on it, but it's at my dad's fishing lodge. And it's the most hideous-looking fish you've ever seen. They found it floating. And I want to say it had a bait in its mouth, which scares you.
So
here's the thing about Fork, y'all. They didn't clear anything but boat lanes for the most part. So it's got a ton of timber in it. And when they flooded it, it was just trees out in the lake. So, I mean, you could be in a cove and not see if anybody else was in the cove with you. And there was fish lost all over the place.
There still are.
There's lots of stories.
I would imagine that almost all the timber is still there. It's just underwater. Like the underwater stuff doesn't rot.
Right.
It'll be there for forever.
Hard as a rock.
Yeah.
And so we also know a guy, Casey and I do, that said, and he's not a guy to elaborate. He's very he has a lot of integrity in the way he does things, and he's not a guy that's going to just throw things out there. And he says that he thinks that he had a bedfish that would have broke the world record at one point, and he could not get it to bite on Lake Fork.
That's the thing that happens.
I mean, and
not the world record part, but just because you see them on
Fork. I mean, there's no doubt that if an 18-18 was caught, that a 20-pounder was probably in the lake at some point.
It existed,
you know what
absolutely.
I mean, they found one floating that when they weighed it was 20. But anyway, so I'm saying all this to set this up. This past weekend at Lake Fork, there was a tournament. It was a Bassmaster Elite Series, I believe, right?
Something like that.
I don't keep up with all the fishing stuff like I used to, and especially the tournament stuff, because generally speaking, the tournament guys are looking for, you know, as many 2-pounders as they can, mm-hmm. And trying to get the biggest 2-pounder they can. On Fork, even with the slot limit, they have now bypassed or found a way around that to weigh big fish and show it on Bass Live, you know, and stuff like that, where they have a guy in the boat who weighs fish officially for these guys, even when they're slot fish. So now these pros come to Fork and they're breaking records, and they broke records in the mid 2010s, I think, mm-hmm. out there for the first time, which is impressive because outside of side imaging, I don't think the live scope existed in those mid 2000s.
No, in fact,
2010.
Before all these records were breaking, I remember because I watched it when it happened. Paul Elias on Lake Amstad was
kneeling and reeling, wasn't
that's
it?
That's him, man. He was throwing DD-22s and jelly worms out in like 25 foot of water, and he broke the then, I think it was the 3-day bag record, and he averaged, I think, over, I mean, there's one day he averaged over 9 pounds in his bag, I think.
Ridiculous.
And we thought that would never be broken again because he hit it, he figured it out on a lake, and it was insane. And he was in one cove the whole time. That interview is cool. We might try to link to that in the description of this podcast. There's some cool stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. You might just need to Google the stuff because there's so many cool things we're talking about.
Yeah, today. It is, man.
But, yeah, he just is the 4-day record. Okay.
More than 130 pounds. That was at Falcon. How about that?
Oh, it was?
He might have broke it somewhere else, but that Falcon one had a 4-day total of 132 pounds, 8 ounces. Previous record, 122 in California.
I'll have to look this up further because I mean, I was like 100% sure it was Amstad, but maybe so. Falcon Lake, sure enough, I just had it wrong in my head.
Yeah, well, they're close.
Yeah, they're pretty close to each other. But yeah, I mean, so 132 for 4 days. So, what does that end up being?
It's almost 7 pounds, probably.
Yeah, insane.
Yeah, and what happened this past weekend in the Bass Elite tournament is a 19-year-old had 130 pounds on Lake Fork.
Mm-hmm.
So people have talked for years and years about how Lake Fork is dying. And I think what I'm going to speak to is why people think this. But I think that what people think is because there's not 16s, 15s, 17s being caught. And also, in fact, the share lunker numbers on Fork have dramatically decreased the last several years. I think that the big fish is still very hard to come by, and maybe that we don't have quite the big, big fish that we used to.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Our friend we were talking about has an interesting theory that I'd like to share at some point in time. Is this the time to do it?
I think so, and I was fixing to say this, maybe. I'm not sure if we're going to say the same
there's
thing.
There's a lot of theories, and you and I can probably present some of those, not as fact, but just as things we have heard and things we could consider plausible. Our friend fished the Bassmaster Tour for 2 years. And he, like Tyler said a while ago, he's a real stand-up dude, very stern kind of guy. You know, he just doesn't fluff anything, right? But he has a lot of theories on stuff. And his main theory as to why the lake doesn't produce like it used to is – or I shouldn't say it's main. One of his theories is that it's self-perpetuating or self-depredating, I guess would probably be the way to put it. The lake had the bass craze of the 80s and 90s, and suddenly it gets more pressure by exponents, right? Like than any other lake in the state. I mean, I remember the fun game in the 90s when I was a kid was to pull up at the boat ramp in March and count how many different states of license plates that you could see, right? And so, to shorten this up a little bit, his theory is that every fish that is on that list right there of the top 50, none of those fish have ever been hooked once in their life. They have no mouth damage. They have no stress of fighting or anything. And he says that because of the lake's pressure and how many fish end up getting hooked throughout their lifetime, he says that a hooked fish will never grow to its full potential. If a fish ever is hooked, like catch and release style, it will never grow to its full potential. And he's speaking about largemouth bass, particularly on Lake Fork. So I would say that one of his main theories is that there are too many fishermen to the extent that there are no bass that never see a bait, that never get hooked, so that they can grow to be in that class. See, I mean, the genetics, are, of course, there, right? It's like going to – you know, one of the big ranches in South Texas and being like, well, the genes are the same they always have been. There's 200-inch deer here, but we're going to shoot all the four-year-olds so they never get to grow to 200 inches. So that's like – and I think that's a pretty – I think it's kind of radical, but it's a pretty plausible theory.
Well, and I think there's also potential that this happened too. A fish that is caught is also extremely susceptible to being – kill to dying at some point, you know, because of bacteria infection.
If you look at catch and release numbers, it's actually pretty depressing.
Yeah,
as far as like the number of fish that survive, and I think more of that research has been done on trout than it has been on other fish. But it's when you're releasing a fish you caught, sure, feel good about it, but you aren't ensuring that fish swims another day.
I can promise you, if you sling it in the boat and it hits the carpet and wipes the slime off of it, it ain't probably going to make it.
No,
it's
going to
get some sort of infection. You know, it's,
or
it's
you
a
ever
lot
let
higher,
if you let its gills dry out at all.
Yeah.
You know, and that was always a thing because the guiding industry took off like wildfire on the lake.
Dude,
right?
The guides were like pros to me.
Yeah.
I mean, they were like celebrities.
They do cool stuff, man. And they know how to catch fish. They did then. They still do. And I mean, like, you look at the pros right here. I would have hated to have fished this tournament they just fished.
Oh, yeah.
It was post-cold front, terrible, right? But they go out and catch a bunch of fish, and we'll talk about why here in a second. But people come down to Lake Fork to catch a biggin. Well, the only way to prove that is with a picture. And we didn't have iPhones and stuff, so you had to use, you know, throwaway cameras or whatever. And there you're trying to get the perfect picture.
They're in your tackle box, deep down in one of your –
So. Guys, you know, aren't practicing what you might call good fish etiquette. It is not something that was even considered in the 90s. You know, the 90s were go and blow, right? Like, the internet age was just taking off. Mm-hmm. We had all the resources we ever needed. You never thought about, like, having to save this fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a million of them.
Right.
There's a 10-pounder on every stump. You ain't worried about it. You know, it's just not even a thought. It's not like – there was no rebellion or bad intent. It was just the way it was.
Well, and guess which fish are dying? The ones that – have a knack to bite a fake bait. You know what I mean? Like, that's the ones that's dying. So the ones that are smart or smarter, or what, for whatever reason, their survival instincts don't really give, they give them an aptitude of figuring out that a bait is fake or not biting that certain type of movement in the red rattle trap or whatever it is. Those fish go on to breed while the other ones die. And now all of a sudden, what you might actually have is a new genetic pool of fish that don't bite very often, and they get closed mouth when the cold front hits anytime, or a weather condition change, or there's any current in the lake at all. And now, over years and, you know, decades of that building up, there might be just, it might be, there's some big fish in there, but once they reach 15 pounds, not only are they, you know, not only are they, you know, old enough and wise enough, but they're, you know,
there's a
they
big
have
spider
that
right there.
Aptitude to
buy the black thing.
Oh yeah, but they have that aptitude that allows them to, you know, not be caught. So
yeah,
you know, maybe the biggest of the bigs are not being caught anymore because all the ones that wanted to bite and were susceptible to baits bought. You know, that's a theory.
Are we continuing on with more theories?
Well, there's another theory about the grass. You know, and the commercial, the like. Mega commercialization of the dairy industry, where a lot of people would say that, because there was a ton of dairy farms when we first
moved out
here.
Hopkins and Wood County, which is the main counties that the drainages lead into,
would have big, like, not big, but many small dairy farms all along the lake shores and stuff.
It was the industry.
Oh, it was, I mean, it was a thing. And then suddenly, big dairy comes in and starts buying out a lot of these little farm operations, and we go into more of a hay production society around here. And now you don't have the cow paddy, you know, wash that goes into these drainages, which creates, you know, grass beds, hydrilla and coontail moss beds, and then also what, algae blooms that the shad would be able to be prolific by eating.
So supposedly, there's a chance that there was a huge algae bloom from the fertilizer and runoff from dairies, and then the shad would then proliferate like unnatural amounts, but then it provides excess amounts of forage for the big fish.
And the hydrilla and coontail gives them places to hide, everything, you know?
It just is a great just environment, right? Yeah. And I think absolutely that's the theory I stand on the most.
Well, and, you know, people, there's a lot of other theories. I probably don't need to say them all because some of them are maybe a little bit hideous.
I have one I just came up with recently I'd like to present to you. Something that nobody talks about, but it is, you've stated that one of the major things that's different about the lake now than it used to be is grass beds.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the grass beds, meaning hydrilla, coontail moss, all these different types of underwater plants that lived on the lake. Lake Fork is a reservoir. And we live in the area of the U.S. that has a lot of reservoirs, and especially where we live, because DFW is the largest metropolitan area outside of, I think, the Bay Area in, you know, New York City, in the in the country, or it's way up there. I don't need to state facts that I'm not sure of, but huge population of people requires a lot of water. That's what Lake Fork was impounded for originally, and all the fishing and the ecotourism and all this stuff that came about because of it is just auxiliary to what the lake actually functions as, and that is a water lake. Well, they didn't start actually using the lake as a water lake until the mid-2000s. Is that right?
I don't. I can't.
Something
add
like
to
that
for sure.
I mean, we drive over it weekly. There's a big old pipeline that you can drive. I remember, this is what they always said: you can drive a Jeep through the middle of it, right? Like that's how big it is, and it's a gravity flow that flows from Lake Fork to Lake Tewakinee, and then that feeds the Metroplex to some, maybe it's Levon or another lake, I don't really know which one. But essentially, Lake Fork is not set up on a major river system. It's controlled by something called the Sabine River Authority, which we won't get into that, but it's actually not on the Sabine River. It's on tributaries to the Sabine River. So unlike a lot of the other large lakes and reservoirs in our area that are variable level lakes, like Texoma or even Tewakinee, because it's on the Sabine River. You look at things like Whitney, that's on the Brazos, I think, right? Like all these lakes around here are variable level lakes to an extent because they're on major rivers. They get bigger floods. They have drought periods. They drop. Fork, in my memory, didn't have anything over a 3-foot lake level swing until the mid to late 90s on a big drought that they decided to work on the lake, and that's when we caught all our big bass, really, is those few years. But in the mid 2000s, suddenly the lake kind of went to a variable level lake, to fluctuating 6 to 8 feet from the late winter to late summer. And those grass beds don't really like to be dry ground.
No.
And when you're doing that every year, you could completely deplete the seed bed or whatever you want to call it, and it no longer can grow the grass like it used to could, because the grass can't build up to be huge beds anymore, because at least once every 2 or 3 years, it's going to dry out and become, you know, dry ground.
So with some of these theories in place, it brings us to an interesting time when the basically, the mid-2010s, people are like, well, the lake's dead. You can catch them better at, you know, OHIV or Falcon. I think during that time, Falcon was especially hot. And so everybody's like, well, the lake's dead. We're not seeing any, hardly any 13-pounders, maybe one or two a year or whatever. Whereas there were years when I think there was like 20-something 13-pounders caught at Lake Fork in the 90s, I believe. And everybody's just like, the hype kind of dies, right? Fork's dead. Well, there is a Toyota Texas Bass Classic decides to come do a Lake Fork tournament.
What year is this?
This is 2014 that I'm speaking to specifically. I think they might have been there the year before or something like that.
I remember
like that
this
too.
Happening.
And a guy from Texas sets a record. His name's Keith Combs. He sets a record for a three-day bag. Now, a bag is how many fish, KC?
So a bag per day is 5 fish.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you get a 5-bass limit in Texas, and that would be what you get to weigh in. And this is when they started allowing them to weigh slot fish and all that kind of thing, right? So a 3-day bag would be 15 fish. He caught 110 pounds.
Yeah.
It's an average of over 7.3 pounds per fish every day. 5 7.3 pounders per day, dude.
Yeah.
Average.
He's not catching 5 7.3s.
No,
he's caught catching a couple fives and a couple giants.
He caught a 10 14, I believe, during the tournament, which is nearly 11 pounds, right? And all of a sudden, everybody's like, what in the world?
Fork's
it's like,
back.
Okay, well, maybe we're not pros, and these guys are. You know what I mean? But
they're good
still,
at it, man.
They are, and there's and this is before the live scoping stuff. And anyway, so there's a lot of questions that are now raised, where the department has been probably taking a lot of heat from people about Lake Fork just dying out, and then all of a sudden they're like, well, it ain't dead yet, you know. Now granted, we haven't seen that many big fish, like when I mean big fish, I'm talking like 15 plus pounders in recent history. But that brings us to this weekend where a four-day tournament average was caught by a 19-year-old that was 130 pounds, which is like 6.5 pounds per fish. Mm-hmm. Also just crazy numbers. And this is not the – these are not like standalone instances. When the pros come to fish in the last decade, they have caught outstanding amounts of big fish. And there was an 11-7 caught in the tournament this weekend, mm-hmm. I think, as well.
And that so, was caught by the guy who won or the guy who got second or something like that, right?
I think you're right. Like, not the guy who won, but one of the guys in the very top right there. Yeah. I'm going to look some of this up. But, you know, it was – so Trey McKinney is a rookie who won this week with 130 pounds, almost 131 pounds.
How wild is it AFCO sponsors this now for what it's worth?
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. It's like an offshore brand, or used to be.
Yeah. So
Michael had on an AFCO shirt the other day.
Did he?
Yeah, he did.
Way to go, Michael.
He's with the times.
He is. Let's see. This guy. Who was the
Justin
guy?
Justin Hamner. He's the one that caught the 11.
Okay, so he was number three. But anyway, regardless.
Look at those kids, man. Young guys catching.
Why is that?
Interesting. KC? That's a great thought. Because the youth of the day are A, more aptly to accept new versions of technology and maybe accept isn't the right word, but like embrace new types of technology, and they're also better at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like Michael absolutely can just run a computer like just better than me or you, like if it's something none of us are familiar with, right?
Yeah.
Like because he was an iPad kid,
mm-hmm.
you know? So like he's been messing with his sleep frog since he was a baby,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas like I just had a chalkboard, you know, so it's different. And I think that that's a huge part of it because technology has become synonymous with bass fishing now. They are one and the same. You don't bass fish without technology.
Mm-hmm. And what technology would lead these guys to be top finishers, maybe?
Let me make a statement before I make that statement.
Mm-hmm.
I am not condoning or condemning something because it's a new thing, mm-hmm. all right? And I think we need to figure something out about it. Because, in fact, I think it's really impressive that these guys will go out there and catch these huge bags of fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's sick to see what the lake can actually do. But they're doing it in a way that's not the same way that, you know,
Keith Combs or Mark Stevenson or any of these guys have ever done.
They're using something called live scope. In fact, there's a video on our YouTube channel of us using some live scope to catch crappie,
mm-hmm.
and it is absolutely like playing a video game in real life. It's a lot of fun. It's very cool. Mm-hmm. But live scope essentially is using it's not sonar. What's that thing called that we do for the baby in the mama's belly?
Ultrasound?
Ultrasound. It's essentially ultrasound. So it sends a wave out, and that wave bounces back, and it's kind of like the length, the focal length or whatever thing that we deal with in cameras. So, like, you can set it for 15 feet or 18 feet, and it has, like, a one-foot span right there that it just projects an image back to you, and it's like you're on the inside of a globe looking out and seeing all the continents on the globe, and that's what's bouncing back at you. So you have this sphere of vision, or it's a hemisphere because it's everything below the water. You can turn this thing and boop, 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 bounce it all directions, and it'll bounce it back to you, and so accurately that you can drop a bait in on a fish that you're looking at, and you can identify what species of fish it is. That's how detailed it is, and you can drop your bait in front of its nose and wiggle it until that fish bites because he can't handle it. Yeah, you can watch it bite even if you don't feel it. In fact, in the crappie thing, mm-hmm. you were setting the hook before you felt the fish.
There was times when he was calling it and he was saying, hey, set the hook.
Because the jig weighs less than the weight that you're using to send it down there,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of weird.
But essentially, on your depth finder, whatever you want to call it, on your screen, you can see how far that fish is out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know he's 15 foot out, then and you've got a 13 foot rod or something, you know, you just reach it out there a couple feet and you got him. Mm-hmm. You got it sitting there. Or you can see that he's next to a tree and there's only one tree in that direction around 15 to 20 feet, then you pitch by that tree or whatever. So super effective. It was in fact, a lot of there's a lot of debate as to whether in the crappie world that there will be population effects because of the ability for people to catch fish when it's cold and they are just suspended on timber in 10 foot of water. Mm-hmm. And you normally wouldn't be fishing suspended, you know, in 10 foot of water. Mm-hmm. Or nor would you have the patience to leave a bait there for 2 minutes while a fish looks at it and, you know, twitch it barely and eventually get him to bite, right? So there's a lot of people that are upset about this stuff, but there's a lot of people that think it's cool too. There's a lot of things that have to be like these departments. They don't react to technology advances nearly as fast as we do. Right. Mm-hmm. They've got to figure out what they got to do some research. What is this? Is this actually
a little bit of a knee jerk reaction to this stuff?
Sure.
Right. It kind of goes back to, we have friends, Mark Kenyon, Tony Peterson, people that we work with who talk about this stuff a lot with cell cameras. And Mark is pretty vehemently against instant pictures on your cell cameras. He sets all his stuff to 24-hour feedback and only uses it that way, which I don't really agree with, but I understand his point. And as long as we can still hang out and talk and be friends, it's fine, right? So, like, everyone's going to have a different reaction to this type of technology stuff, right? I do feel like there are some – I'm a bigger fan of self-regulation than being regulated, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, there are some things that we maybe can and should do to make sure that, like, stuff doesn't get taken away.
And in that vein, there's guide associations on some of these lakes that are, like, saying, hey, we're, you know, for crappie especially on this LiveScope stuff, they're like, you're only keeping X amount of fish a day when taking clients and, you know, only doing this many fish a week or whatever. They got these different stipulations set up. It's that self-regulating. It's kind of neat, you know, that they can do that and pull that off.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, back to what's going on in this scenario. Like, you were telling me the other day that 11.8 or whatever it was that he caught, he saw it on the graph and said, there's two more down there. Just like,
I believe that was the instance I watched on Bass Live was he said he catches, I know one guy caught a giant, I think it was that one, and he was like, there's two more down there right on that log. So
he couldn't get the other two to bite, I imagine.
I didn't watch that long.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, you know, after they see their pal leave out of there and fight.
Get ripped,
you know,
out by his face.
might not be too apt to bite. You know, I've seen that actually happen with catfish in like boat stalls when they go to spawn, and you catch about two and then they shut off, but they're still down there, you know. It's kind of weird, but, you know, here's the thing. If they allow this to be done, then guys are going to use it because look at them total winnings.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
$100,000.
Yeah, and Justin Hammer got $3,000 for just catching the double-digit fish. Yeah. Just on top of that, you know. I mean, you look at that, the top three guys there made, like, median salary off of this one tournament.
Yeah.
You know, like –
yep.
And the other guys, if they get in the money a couple times, have really justified their efforts.
Sure.
You know, so like there's big money in it. And not to mention, that's just the tournament winnings.
Yeah.
These live scopes are cool and they're also expensive, but these guys catching fish like this makes every redneck and every non-redneck alike want to do this because people like to catch big fish, right? So there's a lot of money in sponsorships and partnerships. You look at these guys' boats, they're making a ton of money doing this. And it's going to keep on happening because you can't self-impose a, like, embargo against it. I don't know if embargo is the right word. But, like, you can't just say, I'm going to be a pro and not do this.
Because
guess what? You're going to get outfished.
Yeah,
it's just the way it works.
Well, this, you know, it's something to think about, and I have a somewhat controversial thing to say that I saw on YouTube the other day. I just want to throw this out there just because I think it's interesting. And I had never thought about it, which I don't have the money for a live scope, and you know, I don't guide, so I don't need one necessarily, and. If somebody gave me one, I would for sure have it, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, you got, like you said, you got to figure out, like, would you, if you had that, then you got to decide whether you want to self-regulate or not. But at the end of the day, you know, it is legal. And but the one thing that I was listening to this guy's video that was very interesting the other day that I heard. He said, so the rules in this tournament is that these pros, they cannot foul hook a fish that is on a bed, essentially, that they can see on a bed.
Mm-hmm.
So when they bed, that's when they're spawning. They're going to lay their eggs. They make a bare spot in the bottom so that they can put, you know, eggs down, and they protect that bed, and they're easier to catch. They're more susceptible to being seen and thrown baits at until they bite and get aggravated or whatever. So if you foul hook one, which means you hook him outside of the mouth at all, then the fish does not count towards your bag for the day. And what he was saying is that with this live scope, you're essentially watching fish, and you shouldn't be able to weigh foul hooked fish. But a lot of these guys, because of the cold front you mentioned, are fishing for suspended fish in like 11 foot of water that are halfway up on a tree. They're throwing suspended, you know, jerk baits, stick baits, and letting them sit right there beside these fish, right? And until that fish gets aggravated or whatever and bites it, and they're watching them bite it. And then when they set the hook, them stick baits got, you know, they're long and skinny, and they got bait hooks, you know, two or three hooks on them, and they would be hooked outside the mouth, and they showed it on live and everything, and these fish are hooked outside the mouth, and they let them weigh them. And he was saying, you know, should we be letting this happen if we don't let foul hooked fish that, you know, are hooked while watching them on a bed? Mm-hmm. Is it the same concept here?
I think
so
that
this is another place where technology is just moving so fast we can't even decipher our own rules sometimes against it.
The argument against that, not that I would that I agree with, but the argument against that, I think, would be that, well, bedded fish are there for reproduction, and that's why some people have an issue with fishing for bedded fish at all. And so
most of those guys wear flat bills and fly fish.
Probably live somewhere where 4-pound largemouth's a big one. So that could be, like, at least if you want to talk about the counterpoint, would be that, well, those fish aren't in an active state of reproduction, so therefore you're not affecting the resource like you are a bedded fish.
Sure.
But then it brings up, like, well, should we be fishing for bedded fish at all? I say yes, by the way.
Yeah,
For largemouth, at least. But there's a lot of people that say no. I mean, my world revolved around fishing for bedded fish whenever I was a middle schooler.
It's so much fun.
It is
sick. Dude, it's cool. It's just cool, period, to be in, like, in the shallows when it's clear and just to see the things moving around.
I guarantee you, dude. You think that Shamu made a bunch of kids want to be a marine biologist?
Yeah.
Dude. Bow fishing at night when you can see in the water, what activated me.
50-pound beaver comes in,
dude,
the lights, all of a sudden you think an alligator's fixing to attack you.
And then being up in there in the shallows too, whenever everything else is also doing the spring stuff, where the gar are going nuts, the buffalo are going wild, there's 50-pound fish jumping out of the water all over the place, the turtles are going insane, the coots are going nuts. Like, it's just, it's a really cool time of year to be on the water.
Man. And, you know, this is all, you know, there's so many things to it. Another thing is, like, you are looking at a graph. So, technically, you're looking at an image of something that's real. Mm-hmm. So, if you were to argue against it, it's like, well, you know, if you were graphing fish 10 years ago and you ran a DD-22 down there and it hooked one outside the mouth, nobody thought two minutes about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just, let's just weigh that fish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's something there. But there's so much technology advancement right now. Like, and these guys, there's no telling what their boats are worth, right? Mm-hmm. Because you noticed that they had trolling motors on their power poles.
Mm-hmm.
And our friend Brian, who you may have heard on the podcast before, enlightened us as to what that's for, right?
Brian was like the PR guy for this tournament, by the way. Every time I talked to him, he's like, hey, man, Bassmaster is live on the internet. You should watch it. I was like, why do you care if I watch it or not? It's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So why do they have trolling motors on their power poles?
Brian says, and this we all kind of thought that it was spot lock, you know, because the trolling motor will do that. But he says it's so that they can turn the brakes on instantly when they live scope a fish. They're cruising around. They can drop those.
Flying down the bank, and they see a fish at 30 feet start to come into their ultrasound, and they push reverse, and there's two motors, trolling motors on the back that take off and pull the boat to
stop. I tell
you
what, that live scoping thing – whenever we did it for crappie, one of the things that I remember noting is, like, wow, fish react more to boats than what I thought they did. Mm-hmm. And so I can see where it's valuable in this situation if you are using live scope. If you can hit that fish at 30 feet and stop, there's a chance that you don't disturb him. Where if you get within, you know, the bubble of like 15 to 10 foot, like you're probably – good chance you're spooking that fish.
For sure. It's very interesting, man. And, you know, the whole Lake Fork story is really interesting too. I would say, you know, personally speaking, I don't know that there's big 15-pounders like there used to be, but apparently there's 7-pounders like there – maybe has never been, you know. Mm-hmm. Who knows, right?
Well, we've been talking about this for a while, that the lake was low for a very long time, like a 3 or 4 year span. And then we've had like 3 or 4 spawns that the lake has been up.
And kind of muddy, too.
Yeah, the brush has been in the shallows. And I feel like not as many fish have been caught
for
the past few years. And we might be starting to see that play out.
And those fish had a lot of brush to protect them from getting eaten when they were small by crappie and bluegill and stuff like that. So it's potentially we're seeing some of that payoff right now.
In fact, I think today I would like to do my best for largemouth bass conservation. Largemouth bass conservation.
Bath Body Works.
I think that we should go try to remove as many crappie from the lake as we possibly can so that we can help impact the largemouth.
Let's go do that, man.
All right. Remember, it's fishing season. Remember,
this is your element.
Live it.
You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29th, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30th, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1st, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2nd, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4th, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5th, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.